In this episode of The Critical Myth, The Critical Myth crew explores the ramifications of Continuum, defends the wall with Game of Thrones, and takes a stand with Turn. It's episode 458, Continuum Goes Insane.
Episode 458 of The Critical Myth. I am John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and I always find the best thing for a marriage is shared murders of negligence.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and, you know, copies can be more fun than you think.
And I think that everybody should spend a little bit of time on a wall contemplating... as large spikes come flying up and sending you yards into the background. Anyway, we are going to be talking about all kinds of shows that are currently running. That means probably less than we are used to, but we're still going to dig into these quite a bit. So, Edmund, if you could give a disclaimer.
Absolutely. We like to discuss anything that might have happened on these shows, so you will be horribly spoiled, but there's so little on at the moment, you really should have seen them by now anyway.
That's right, and we're going to go ahead then, and Gary, why don't you give us our first topic to discuss?
I would like to talk about my favorite current show, which is Continuum.
All right, and let's go ahead then and run the promo.
On the next Continuum.
He dug up a time travel device.
No! I'm not going back in the box!
We don't have him, Kira.
Something happened.
I need to find the freelancers, retrieve something they took.
Those guys tend to find you, and it doesn't usually go too well.
I'm sorry, I want to make the world a better place and change this dark future that I'm supposed to create.
Continuum. New episode Sunday at 9. Exclusively on Showcase.
And if you could do the recap, please.
Yes, we're talking about the sci-fi original series. Continuum, Season 3, Episode 11, 3 Minutes to Midnight. A direct attack from Liberate puts Kira and John Doe in danger. At the same time, they confront the harsh realities of their relationship's origins. Meanwhile, Alex struggles with the fact that his new invention is responsible for Jason's increasingly odd behavior.
Okay, and what would you give this one?
I would give it... 8.5.
All right, and Edmund?
I will give it a 9.
And I was going to give it an 8.5. So we're all fairly close here and definitely above average with our thoughts. But let's go ahead and kind of parse this out a little bit. And, well, we have the attack from Liberate against Kira and John Doe. And also they get to confront the harsh reality of their relationship's origins. And I mentioned both of these at the same time because you really can't separate them by the end of this episode at all. Yeah, so there's a little bit of a temporal puzzle going on here. Would somebody please explain it to me?
Well, you wanted to parse out the beginning, but I really wanted to talk about the whole end scene because I felt that was the most dramatic of this episode, but I'll hold off and we'll go according to your plan. You know, basically it turns out that there's more than one timeline. There's more than two timelines. There's more than three timelines. We don't really know how many timelines there are at this point. But regardless, in one timeline, you know, Kira got killed. In the other timeline, you know, she did fine. And we don't know which one we're in at this point.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it sounds to me... I'll admit, I was really quite confused. It sounded to me like the idea is that when it was, the damage was already started when Liberate and Kira went back in time, but it was a relatively closed loop because of the way that things were progressing, or at least they thought it was. Alec kind of doubling down on that by jumping a week in the past to save Emily has completely thrown things into a complete tailspin. And while it explains why the freelancers are focusing on this particular point so intently, because there are so many branches now that need to be culled, well, it kind of gets confusing because for a time travel show, it's basically saying that no fate but that which you make. And anyone can make their own fate at this point. It could go anywhere. So it might as well be that there is no future to worry about anymore.
Well, that's exactly right. They're all screwed. Yeah. Nothing they're going to do is going to get anyone back to where they want to go to for certainty's sake. And, you know, it sort of shows the, the sort of time police guys, because they're just trying to stop more fracturing. They're not even trying to fix anything, I think, at this point. They're just trying to minimize damage. And here all these people are jumping through time and, you know, and basically mucking things up even worse. And, you know, it went from a predestination paradox type of thing where Alex was going to create the company that sent them back, to now it's literally burst wide open.
Yeah, absolutely.
Kira's killer isn't from Kira's future.
Yeah. I mean, it's like try to parse this out. Try and figure out cause and effect. Good luck with that. Edmund, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, I'm just all over the map as far as what my thoughts are on this. It kind of threw me completely for a loop.
Yeah, well, certainly, I mean, the little hints they've been dropping the last couple of episodes, I mean, we're all coming to fruition. And I actually kind of like what they're doing in terms of throwing it into so much disarray, because it always did seem to, you know, a little too neat to have it just be a show where older Alec has sent them back because he remembers that's what happened when he was a kid, and helped, you know, and so it was necessary to make sure it all happened that way again. I really like, we've talked about how this is one of the few shows that really does try and delve into hard science fiction, throwing it into this much disarray. And I know I agree with Gary that, I mean, I really do want to just go to that final scene, because I was stunned at having a TV show where you're actually having these characters having this big confrontation and not just winding up in random gunfire, but everybody discussing these concepts and all the different reactions to them. And what also amazes me is after this show has been so much about Kira wanting to get back to her future, it really did seem to, it seems to reach the point where that future is going to be impossible to get back to. And we've had Carlos having his troubles dealing with dead Kira versus alive Kira, and certainly Jason having his issues, and even the hint that was dropped that he's actually been in the Freelancer's glass cages at one point. He had that outburst of don't put me back in the box. So yeah, it's really thrown things into question, and I think they've set themselves a pretty intriguingly difficult task to try and reconcile all this in the last two episodes. But I've got my fingers crossed that they do have a way of parsing this out now that they've thrown everything into such chaos.
I mean, you brought up the fact that, you know, Jason is having issues and all of that. What are your thoughts on where that's going?
Well, that certainly seemed to be the classic conundrum of advancing things too fast, and trying to do technology that's supposed to be from 20 years from now and bring it forward till to now, and certainly with all the side effects they were dealing with, and Dylan having to go around and clean up the mess. Seemed to me it was just another lesson in the difficulties of shifting things around temporally. That if you try and cram something into the wrong time space, it's just not going to work properly.
How about you, Gary?
Well, I agree. You know, that moment at the end that we both seem to be zeroing in on, when they all of them just sat down and just put their guns down and just sort of realized that it's all pointless, that they just gave up, was really a transcendent moment for me in this episode. All their animosity and goals to go forward. While I've heard some people talk about how, oh well, that means that they can make everything happen that they want to happen. yes, but it's not going to be that easy anymore. And it's going to be a lot more ugly, and it's not going to turn out the way that we thought. Much as the Kira's John Doe slash killer knew about Kellogg, but didn't know about Alec. So I thought that was a nice touch to indicate how much things continue to change. Now, you heard a little bit of it, or at least I heard it. I know I was watching this with my wife, and she skipped over as they were talking about the tech of John Doe's gun, how they were talking about how it looked cobbled together and sort of like a cave. I forget what the exact analogy was, something about a caveman playing with a computer or something like that. And so I'd figured it out, but when they actually, when he made that statement, it just tells you that it was from the future. And then he described a dystopian future that didn't match Kira's dream or Liberate's dream, really, as he went into the depths of how bad it had become. And, first you thought, oh gosh, they screwed things up, now they can fix it again. But no, they went even further and just said, no, even that's not right. So it really shook things up for me.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't know. Any other thoughts on this one? I mean, as you said, Edmund, we really got to see how the next two episodes parse out. But to me, this almost brought to an end the familiar conflicts. Because really, any idea of preventing future A, future B, future C, it's like Gary said, they all kind of sat down and went, it's pointless. Why are we even bothering to preserve something that doesn't necessarily exist anymore? None of their futures exist anymore.
Yeah, and just bringing up the point of no matter how much you try and guide it and push it towards a certain goal, it seems almost impossible to anticipate what the ramifications are going to be, because certainly. I was trying to remember. I know John Doe did finally get his name, but I don't remember it. Certainly John Doe's future. But I love the initial reaction of Liberate of like, oh, you don't have the corporate Congress. Good, we won. This is the future we want. And then he starts describing it, and it's like, no, you don't necessarily want that to happen. So the whole be careful what you wish for cliche just brought to life.
Hmm. Again, anything else that we want to say about this particular episode? I'm guessing not, then.
I think we hit all the major points.
All right, that being said, then, there is one other point that I want to make. The other reason that I really want the next two episodes to clarify everything is because, quite to the contrary of everyone's expectations, there's been no announcement about Continuum Season 4.
That makes
me nervous.
Well, it's getting excellent ratings in Canada. I'm not sure about the sci-fi ratings.
Well, up until this point, it hasn't mattered. But are we getting into a range or a time period where even in Canada, they need these international deals to be preserved in order to keep it going?
Well, it was my understanding that this is done in Canada and sci-fi just buys the show from them later. I didn't think it was some sort of joint production or anything along those lines. I thought it was a straight purchase.
Wondering if maybe they've been factoring in the purchase in some way, shape, or form, but I don't know. It seems odd to me because everyone involved with the production even seems a little bit taken aback that they kind of expected something by now, given how well things seem to be going for them. So, I don't know. We'll see. I'm a little concerned. Let's see. So let's go ahead then, and Edmund, why don't you choose our next topic?
Get into that great big battle on Game of Thrones.
All right, and let's go ahead and run what is no doubt a very exciting promo.
Love is the death of duty. It's time. Tonight, we fight! And when the sun rises, I promise you, Castle Black will stand!
All right, and if you could do the recap for us.
Certainly. Game of Thrones, Season 4, Episode 9, The Watchers on the Wall. The Night's Watch are confronted with the most dangerous challenge to Castle Black ever seen as wildlings attack the ancient fortress from both sides of the wall.
Uh-huh. And what would you give this one?
I will give this a 9.
Okay. And Gary?
I would give it an 8.
Okay. And I believe I gave it a 9, but I need to go and check over on bognetwork.com, where my review happens to reside currently. In the meantime, well, geez, where do we even start with this? Gary, just where do you want to dig into this first?
Well, I'd like to mention it was sort of a unique format for the show. They never went anywhere else, which was odd. Even during some of the bigger events like the Red Wedding and stuff, you still had a little moving between locales or characters, where this one, pretty other than up and down on the wall, you stayed there the whole time, which was unexpected, and I almost wanted to see some other development with like Sansa and stuff like that, but we stayed here the whole time, so it seemed it was sort of unique for the show. That being said, we got to see how bad a state the Night's Watch was really in. Not that they didn't fight, you know, brilliantly and even win, but at the same time, you saw the disorganization, the lack of personnel that has been hinted at since the first episode of the series, when they talk about sending John or sending anybody up out to the wall. They need men. And so we've heard this for season upon season, and now we actually see, yes, it was true, and gosh, they could have used a few extra hundred people on this wall. And we constantly hear about the sad shape of things, and we really got to see it in a large extent. They were really pulling out every trick and every bit of bravery they could, and they barely got through by the skin of their teeth.
It's an interesting way of looking at it. Because, yes, I think that is exactly how it played out. But for me, at least, in watching this unfold, what came to mind was that if it hadn't been for the band of wildlings coming from the south, I think they would have been okay. The defense of what was hitting them from north of the wall was actually pretty solid. If they weren't distracted, it would have even been more so, I think. Of course, it's kind of hard to pay attention to the huge throng coming at you from one direction when there's a much smaller throng coming in and gutting you. Because, man, they just came in and wiped the floor with the Night's Watch for a while there. So I'm thinking that, this... By the time that you get to the end of this, certainly you're supposed to be left with the impression that they survived one night, but they really can't expect for this to last much longer. And certainly that's exacerbated by the situation with Ygritte's band that came in and took out, what, a quarter of the Night's Watch? I mean, when all is said and done?
Oh, yeah, probably.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I mean, they lost huge numbers for what few they had. And how many of them are injured that did survive? So, yeah. Edmund, what are your thoughts just in general on this?
Yeah, no, well, certainly it was very surprising having the entire episode just be this battle. I mean, they had sort of worked up to this earlier in the season with Joffrey's wedding and Tyrion's trial taking up a good half of an episode. I will say that probably is one of the reasons why I was giving it the good score of a 9, but I was feeling like it as thrilling as the battle was, and I thought the cinematography and the effects, and they really went all out, and did make for a very good battle. But I was feeling a little bit left out of the what was going on in the other storylines. It was actually that I certainly got that. Well, I mean, they Jon Snow pretty much lays it out at the end of the episode that yes, we fought them off for tonight, but we can't keep doing this. It actually almost reminded me a little bit of the Person of Interest finale, where you're thinking they're going towards a big victory, and then it gets to the end, and it's like, no, we're just trying to survive, and we're not sure we can do that. So. Yeah, I thought it was a tour de force episode in terms of the action. I hadn't necessarily thought about it, but I think you do have a good point, John, about it was the guerrilla tactics behind them that was the most damaging, and certainly pointed up and have what's been hammered home for over these four seasons about the not just the numbers but the decline in quality of the members of the Night's Watch. You know, so there was some some interesting turnarounds where after all season we've been programmed to really despise the current Lord Commander. It was it was good to see him actually step up and be a leader for as long as he could, anyway, until he was at least taken off the field. And we're not quite sure if he's survived or not yet. I guess without that, well, we will find that out down the road. But that was a nice little nice little turnaround to see that. No, they weren't all completely incompetent, but when push came to shove.
Yeah, I mean, the amazing thing, Gary, you mentioned this already, the fact that it was so focused on this one location, and even when we had the Battle of Blackwater, which is probably the closest analog to this that we've had on the show, there were so many different facets to it that there was a lot to say. I would say really the only thing that is worthy of digging into here in any depth is the fact that you had two relationships kind of come to a very important point. The most obvious of those is John and Ygritte. Now, Gary, had you gotten to this point in the book yet, or was this a bit of a surprise to you?
It was a surprise.
Okay. Your thoughts?
I mean, I shouldn't take that. I shouldn't say it was a complete surprise, but when it happened, it didn't surprise me, but I didn't expect it to end quite that way. I figured she would have shot him at least one more time.
Just wound him a little. Anyway.
That's what I was thinking.
Now, Edmund, remind me, maybe you remember better than I do, but I was fairly certain that that's not how it played out in the book.
No, I mean my memory of the in the book it was kind of more anonymous that and of course I mean you know they may reach this point but the actual end of the battle in the book is handled quite differently, although this could have just been set up for to make it look like everything's hopeless, and then they will do something like what happened in the books could still happen, but it was more that she was just part of the attack and gets killed when things turn around in favor of the Night's Watch, and John finds her body, but there was no moment of the two of them facing each other the way there was here, even though in terms of for the drama of it and the fact that we are dealing with a visual TV show rather than just the written word, it did make sense that they had to bring them into this sort of direct conflict. Even if it did seem like a bit of a cheat to have the little elevator boy being the one who actually took her out. that felt a little anticlimactic.
I did think that it was nice for them to have that one moment, though, because it did speak to the fact that regardless of how it all played out and that there was this inevitable tragedy to it all, there was genuine emotion there and regret over how things were going to end. But it was, again, one of those things where it wasn't the duty that he had to perform, and even the duty that she felt to her people was never going to allow this to happen. And that was fairly obvious from the beginning. Now, of course, we also had the things kind of take a certain direction between Sam and Gilly. What were your thoughts on that, Gary?
Well, I just want to touch back on, actually, I'll talk about Sam a little bit, but also the whole Jon Snow thing. In a way, when Jon Snow was having his talk with Sam about breaking his vows and stuff like that, you know, Sam basically informed him, you're looking at this a little too strict. You actually haven't broken your vows yet, so all the stuff you've done, you're still, you know, still officially a Night's Watchman. You haven't really broken your oath. And so, you know, as he reaches that point, you know, it helped, at least in my mind, helped strengthen that, you know, he still needed to do his duty. And, you know, that was, you know, fighting, going to against these people and possibly Ingrid was all right. And he was still doing his sworn oath. He hadn't actually, you know, thrown it to the wind the way he had talked about earlier on.
How about you, Edmund?
I like the build up to it, and the whole exchange with Sam and Maester Aemon, and also, I mean, as I was talking about the Lord Commander stepping up, but our conniving former head of the King's Landing troops basically cutting and running was also another nice character bit in the opposite direction, completely in character for the way he's been set up. Yeah, with Sam and Gilly, I did really enjoy Sam needling and probing John up at the top of the wall, and to try and get him to talk about it, just so he could finally find out what it's like. But then the way it played out, I'm perfectly happy with the prospect that that Sam may finally find some happiness, because he certainly deserves it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. We'll see how long the good fortune up at the wall lasts for him to actually get that moment, though. So we leave this with John going to go confront Mance and maybe try to have what may seem a little familiar here, a one-on-one to stop this huge slaughter once and for all, maybe kill Mance in the process, and hope that taking out the Emperor will stop the Empire. I mean, killing the leader will convince the wildlings to give up. What are your thoughts on that, Gary? Good idea, yeah, bad idea, really incredibly stupid idea, which...
I think it's a really incredibly stupid idea, especially as we saw the scene leading up to this in the Wildlings camp, where we talk about Jon Snow and that it's the girl's right to slay him and not to touch him. So he's obviously well-known, high-profile, so let's go try and sneak in and kill the leader of this ever, the biggest ever Wildlings group that's ever come together. Mm. I just don't see how he's going to pull... I can't see how he can infiltrate something like this, so... It seems awfully shaky, even with his month-long knowledge of the Wildings, if I recall correctly.
Mm.
So, I think it's foolhardy, but it makes a certain amount of sense. If this Mance was the unifying force of the Wildings, killing him might fractionalize them. So it's not without merit, but at the same time, I don't see how he's the one to do it.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Now, Edmund, how about you? I don't want to spoil anything for Gary as far as the book is concerned, but
thank you.
Yeah. Thoughts on
it does seem pretty foolhardy.
Yes,
especially going out there completely alone and not even taking Ghost. Since Ghost had proved his utility quite well on the during the battle, but. Certainly setting up. I mean, yeah, because I wasn't quite sure if his intention is to sneak in or present himself as the representative to parlay and then kill him during the parlay. So we will see. But it did seem like a pretty desperate move, and it is hard to see how it's actually going to succeed.
Mm. Yeah, so I don't really... I guess there's a lot that's going to have to happen in the finale in order for some of these plot lines to be wrapped up for the third season, or fourth season, rather. Any predictions, Gary?
No, I'm wide open. I don't want to know what's going to happen, so I don't want to hear any reaction when I say something, like I sometimes do. So I will just keep an open mind.
Gotcha. No problem. All right, then we are going to go into our mid-show break, and then we'll be back with what I think will be Gary's next choice, so stay tuned.
We'll be right back.
Okay, and we're back, and well, Gary, there doesn't seem a lot to choose from here. Anything that you want to add, or do we just want to jump on to what's on the list?
We'll just jump in as I'm thinking about this episode. I guess it really is our time travel episode, because now I want to switch over to Turn back in the colonial times.
All right, and let's go ahead. And there's actually two episodes that we need to talk about. Let's go ahead and run the promo for the first one.
Don't you see who your real enemies are?
They both have our roles to play for Washington.
Help!
Someone's trying to kill you, sir.
These are our friends we're lying to.
Arrest every name on this list.
Albert!
You bring the war here?
The war is already here.
Turn. All right, and if you could do the recap, please.
Absolutely. We're talking about Turn. First off, we're still in Season 1, Episode 9, Against Thy Neighbor. Simcoe ignites a political witch hunt to weed out rebel conspirators in
Setauket.
Oh. Meanwhile, Washington assigns Ben to a secret mission. Dum, dum, dum.
All right, and what would you give this one?
I would give it an 8.
All right, and Edmund?
I think I'm good with an 8 as well.
Yes, I think that is going to be my choice, as typically is with the show. And, all right, Gary, why don't you go ahead and get us kind of started off. Do we want to start with Simcoe and his little political witch hunt?
Yeah, I'm just trying to keep in my head so I can don't mix these two episodes up, because I watched them back to back, actually. See, this is the he's going.
Edmund, why don't you help us out?
Yeah, yeah. Let's start off. I'm getting them mixed up, so I don't want to jump.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, we've been. I mean, seeing now Simcoe's, you know, his obsessions and coming to the fore, and I mean, it was no surprise once he got back. He really wants to kind of up the ante and try, you know, and get a real handle on the conspiracies he's been seeing. Yeah, I mean the whole setup. I mean this whole thing of that, you know, and even though, I mean, he does see this, you know, he's sure there's stuff going on. I mean, the fact that of course, you know, he basically creates it all himself. The whole poisoning of the horse and using that to basically push the major into going after the town and really starting to try and dig out the rot. Yeah, it was, you know, it was quite shocking. Also it was very effective in terms of showing how, as pleasant and benevolent a sort of dictator as Hewlett's been, that push the right buttons and under the right circumstances, he really could really be pushed into these more extreme measures.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, obviously Simcoe is engineering this whole situation that happens in Setauket, and it amounts to a really trying to take out Abe's father mm-hmm. as a prominent member of the community in order to root out those that he feels are either guilty or may, through their reactions, expose their guilt. And we get this odd little scene where Abe is like, oh, well, Dad, I can't, you know, you can't do this. You can't prosecute this whole case, you know, according to proper form. So I'll do it.
Yes.
And, you know, clearly he's trying to do this because this is one way for him as a conspirator to actually kind of save the conspiracy as much as possible. But I guess maybe, I know, not being a lawyer, I was expecting something slightly more reserved and not so crazy. Because there was a lot of nutty stuff going on in his whole presentation of this. He was going way over the top, at least from my perspective. What do you think about that? Gary, now perhaps you remember which one we're talking about.
Yes, yeah, I did. All that I think was for a second was courtroom, and then I saw that it all came flooding back to me. Yeah, I mean, I was surprised to see him, you know, in this role. At the same time, While he was, it did get a little crazy from time to time. I thought it really made the British soldiers seem sympathetic, and I was not expecting that sort of angle or twist to things. You know, they just seemed generally confused, and just things got out of hand, and I felt I understood how they got out of hand. So I was surprised that, again, they were portraying them so sympathetically, as opposed to how we're typically see them as just, brutes, so to speak, and, imposing their wills. You know, it seemed that these, at least the rank and file soldiers, were, rather earnest and to some extent just trying to defend themselves when one person fired and then it just let loose. So when they, came back with the verdict of them being not guilty, as a U.S. citizen now, I really didn't feel, sort of outraged or anything like that, that was arrived at. It seemed, logical and reasonable, and I like that they're not making this – I like that they made it not as one-sided anti-British as many episodes are.
Hmm. I guess what really kind of threw me off and threw me for a curve is this – it all comes down to this big thing where it's like, here, I'm going to show that this bullet clearly came out of this rifle, and it's just woefully not even close. I mean, it's not like, if I just jam a little bit, it'll get in there. It's like not even going to possibly, physics cannot be rewritten kind of situation. And I'm just sitting back and wondering, did no one check this at all previously? It just, the whole courtroom thing. And granted, I gave this an 8 because it was very entertaining, but it felt like, whoa, where, this went way off the rails at some point. And, like, I could almost feel like nobody was going to stop this because no one quite knew what was going on. It's like, are you going to stop them? Because I don't know. Edmund, what do you think? I mean, it's...
That was certainly sort of the Perry Mason moment, I couldn't help myself sort of harking back to O.J. Simpson in the glove, but I did think it was an interesting strategy of Abe's to, as he said, to try and aggressively prosecute the case, but in so doing, trying to expose all the holes in it. Yeah, as you say, John. I mean, it was very entertaining, but I wasn't sure I suppose in the end it did work in terms of Hewlett. I mean, Hewlett was standing his ground, but managing to get him to assign them to the prison ship, even though, of course, that is essentially the same as a death sentence, having seen the ship, just a longer, slower one. So it seemed a case of sort of a Pyrrhic victory, where yes, they're still alive, but they're certainly still some issues to deal with, which makes sense since it's the setup for the finale.
Hmm. Yeah, so why don't we go ahead then and jump to that and play the next promo.
Sunday, on the season finale of Turn, the revolution hits home.
Come on back!
So this raid is personal.
You're a spy for Washington!
We're in a fight to the death now!
All right, and Gary, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. We're talking about Episode 10, The Battle of Setauket. In the first season finale, Mary grapples with the realization that Abe is a rebel spy. Meanwhile, Ben and Caleb lead a raid on Setauket to save the Patriot families.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what would you give this one?
I'd give it a 9.
All right, and Edmund?
I will go 8.5.
As will I. I will also do that. Okay. Well, Gary, why don't you get us started? What's your kind of high point? You went from an 8 to a 9, and certainly...
Oh, yeah. No, I thought this did a bunch of things. You had the intrigue about the husband coming back that everyone thought was dead. You had Abe's spy book being found out, and I'm not quite sure if his wife actually set him up or not. I'm thinking yes. But I couldn't quite get a solid read on that. And then you had the whole battle scene, which showed that, the the Colonials rising up against the British regulars and them actually getting ready to trounce them, but they weren't rubbing it in their face. They just wanted to free the prisoners, and then they dispersed back and left the area. You saw the reinforcements for the British coming, but just a little too late. And I liked it; sort of gave you a sense of how maybe some of these battles were fought back then. You know, back before you had tanks and airplanes and all that. And I thought it was believable. There were a lot of good things to this episode that I liked.
Edmund, how about you?
Certainly compared to the huge battle we were talking about in Game of Thrones, I mean, this was a very interesting little skirmish, and like Gary, I enjoyed seeing the sort of different tactics that when you're dealing with muskets and cannon, and certainly in terms of the firearms and rifles, when you have weaponry that isn't quite as accurate as you might hope for nowadays, changed the way the tactics worked. Just the little nuances of the powder being left behind, and the rebels managing to grab it, or grab at least as much as they can, and Hewlett ordering that while the rifles and muskets may be not that accurate, that it did certainly point up that the British did know how to fire cannons very well, and not by design. Of course, they do manage to wind up hitting the powder, the armory, when no one is actually in it, so it's the carnage isn't quite as great as it might have been, but I think that also worked in favor of the eventual truth that gets worked out. On that score, it really was pointing up as well, just that whole sense of it being that different time, and where there is that sort of code of honor about honoring white flags and taking the what advantage you can, but also knowing when to retreat and let things go. It was a very different battle from Game of Thrones, but I thought also rather well done in the way it was laid out.
What struck me was, of course, I knew that this was the case anyway, just from history, but, okay, so we've got a rebel force and we've got the British force. The big movement that throws everybody for a loop on the British side is those stinking patriots flanked us. That's as complicated as it got, and it worked.
Yes. They ran over to those trees over there. Yeah. Oh, no.
two groups of them. Well, now our cannons are useless.
So much for all those headstones, eh?
Yeah, exactly. It was just like, I know this is how it worked, but still, it's hilarious when you think about it. It's like, yes, this was also still the era when it was fashionable to just get in a line and shoot at each other.
Yes.
Like, hiding? What do you mean hiding? You know, meanwhile, Legret and her band of wildlings is like having a real good laugh, but it's still a little bit, it's played as straight as it needs to be played. I mean, because it is accurate, but it still seems so ludicrous to modern sensibilities that this is as complicated as you had to get to completely outwit your opponent. But I did like how it all played out. I think that it had its moments, especially when Simcoe completely loses it. And then we have, like you said, that moment at the end where, okay, what does it really mean for Abe's wife to discover this? And it seems to me like she decides, well, he's just not going to be able to do this himself. It's almost like, well, he's a guy. This ain't gonna work. He's gonna need me to do this with him because he's clueless. Which is not entirely inaccurate when it comes to Abe. But I like the idea that it's now the family business. If nothing else, because Abe's partner has been Anna. Well, now Anna's husband is back. That's gonna complicate matters. And granted, he's not there, but he's alive. That's good enough. But now, of course, Abe is going to be working with his wife to a certain extent. So it's like, oh, my, his whole situation, which seemed like it was going to resolve itself, is now even more complicated. Yay!
Yeah, although, I mean, I really like the way they played that out, though, because I really felt that she was ready to to give up on him, or even potentially to turn him in. And then it was driven to a head when their soldier lodger comes in at exactly the wrong time, and it was more when once Abe shot him, and that was what then galvanized his wife to take the different tack and as you say take charge of things, and I found believable. I mean, I think if it's we still don't know if it's coming back next season, of course, but did set things up well and took a character who seemed kind of peripheral, not that well fleshed out, and obviously gives her a very major role going forward, and given that ambivalence, and of course the fact that her rival is still around after leaping out of the boat, certainly, you know, lots of room for some more conflict and ambiguity.
I wonder why I thought that the show had been renewed. Am I misremembering? Well, whatever the case.
Well, considering I was wrong about Beauty and the Beast earlier in the week, I might have been.
No, of course, this is the one that you're right about.
There may be that alternate timeline where I'm reading these articles.
Exactly. I'm thinking
please
the other
stay
timeline.
On the right timeline. I know it's tricky anymore, but...
Nope. The timeline that I thought Turn had been renewed, apparently it still has not yet been renewed, but... thanks for reminding me that Beauty and the Beast has been and Turn has not, but which is kind of ironic, especially when we consider the fact that Turn's first season came in at a whopping 8.2, which is a really good opening salvo for any show. So, I'd say that it is deserving of coming back if AMC is listening, because, you know, we're the one that they listen to when it comes to renewals. Certainly. Sure. Yeah, absolutely. No question. All right. Let's see then. What shall we do? I think then we are pretty much wrapped up on the stuff that, Gary, you watch with us. Anything that you want to add as far as exciting activity and things to watch, things to whatever, go see in the theater? I don't know.
No, I think that'll be it for tonight, John, but I'll work hard to come up with new material so I can get in on episode 3 of the week.
Well, I'm just going to throw out a recommendation while I still have you somewhat captive, and I have finished the most recent of the Dresden Files books.
I have it on my nightstand, but I'm still trying to get through Game of Thrones.
Oh, yes.
You're sucking up. I was like, I would have had 6 books read in the time it took me to read the last 3.
Absolutely, but I will say it is definitely worth the time and the wait. These books are always quite enjoyable, and I actually have a review pending to go up on VogNetwork.com of Skin Game, the most recent Dresden book.
Oh, no, yeah, it's a great series. I've really enjoyed it. It's for the heavy subjects it sometimes deals with in a very light manner that doesn't sort of bog you down, or sometimes you'll read a book, it'll even get you depressed because it's just so grim, but this book, this character usually manages to sort of keep your head up a little bit, even during the grimmest of situations.
Yes, absolutely.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review. So let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as Fair Use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the Critical Myth.